1 Samuel 14. So let's rebuild the setting just a little bit. Okay. Saul was down at Gilgal, down in the plainland of the Jordan Valley, and he was waiting there for Samuel to come and give him instruction and sacrifice with him and make sure his relationship with the Lord was right, while the Philistine army amassed up in the mountains at Michmash. Huge, huge army. And Saul waited 7 days, but not quite long enough. And he decided to take things into his own hands, offered the sacrifice himself, contrary to God's instruction in the Mosaic Law and contrary to God's instruction from Samuel. And he disobeyed God. So he offered the sacrifice himself. As soon as he did, Samuel arrives and tells Saul, now your dynasty will not be established in Israel. So your dynasty is not going to be the one that lasts for a long time. And as history will bear out, Samuel didn't tell him this, but we find out that his dynasty is only going to last two generations, and not even two full generations. His son, who takes the throne after him, will be ousted from the kingdom fairly quickly, within just a few years. So, Saul leaves Gilgal with that message ringing in his ears. You've disobeyed the Lord. The Lord's rejected your dynasty. Your house has been rejected. You're not going to stand before the Lord. Saul goes back up the mountains, skirts around Michmash, and goes back to his hometown of Gibeah. And that's about where we find him. Okay? The Philistine army has been sending raiding parties out into the territory around Michmash, wreaking havoc, devastating things, probably trying to find food to feed an army the size that they have there. One of the tactics, even in the, in the Civil War, for Robert E. Lee was to get his army in the northern territory, not as much for a tactical advantage as just to start feeding off the land, so that he wouldn't have to burden the southern states with the necessities of his army, give them time to rebuild their supplies if he could find enough off of the northern land. And he did for a little while. In the long run, didn't help him out. But that's what the Philistines are doing here. They're camped around Michmash, which is an Israelite town, and they're sending out their raiding parties in every which direction. And Saul, we find out, is staying at Gibeah. And that's where we pick up chapter 14, verse 1. One day, Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side." So here is the introduction to the story. And he tells us what Jonathan's plan is. He says to his armor bearer, "Let's go over to the other side. Let's just go over to the Philistine garrison." That's a pretty bold venture. Him and his armor bearer. Now, if you remember one other detail I forgot to mention about the Israelite situation, not only have the Philistines invaded their country with a massive army, not only has Saul been told that God has rejected his household, not only has Saul not received any divine instruction regarding the battle, but one other minor detail, none of the Israelite soldiers has a weapon. There's no swords or spears or anything found amongst all the people of Israel except with Saul and Jonathan. So, one of the two guys that has a weapon in his hand says to his armor bearer, "Well, how about you and I go over there and see what we can do?" This is a bold plan. Okay. Talk about an underdog story. This is going to mirror another event that's going to happen in just a few chapters. It's going to tell us why it is Jonathan and David become such fast friends later in life, because they've both got the same kind of faith. Jonathan, him and his armor bearer, go over to face a massive army all by themselves. And David is willing to stand up without a sword at all and fight one of the biggest guys that's ever lived. Goliath, a man who stands over 9 feet tall. Jonathan's got a bold plan. So the writer of Samuel has introduced this narrative with Jonathan's bold plan. And he gets your tastes flowing for a great adventure story here, but then he's going to step back a second and say, not so fast. We got a few background tidbits we need to give you before we can really get into the actual story. So, some background tidbits, starting in verse 2. Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah in the pomegranate cave at Migron. I'm going to show you a map here in just a minute. I know keeping track of all these town names is tricky. Okay. It's kind of akin to us moving here for the first time, and everybody, well, you know where Lamoille's at, right? You know where Troy Grove is, right? Well, you know, it's near here, right? I got caught in that one time. I was talking to somebody, and he mentioned he was from some town. I said, oh, okay. And he said, oh, you know where that's at? I said, no. I was just mentally asserting that I'm listening, but I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, I know. We know the big town. We know where Mendota's at. All right. We got Mendota down, and Peru, of course. Wait, yeah, Peru's that way. I still have trouble inside this building. Get me outside, and I'm okay. Mendota, Peru, Rockford, way up there, Rochelle. Okay, so I'll show you a map here in a minute. But suffice it to say, Gibeah is 5 miles from Michmash. Michmash is where the Philistine army is camped. So Saul is on the northern outskirts of Gibeah, so he's only a few miles from his mortal enemy. All right, it's not a great position to be in. And he's hiding. He's staying in the outskirts of Gibeah in the pomegranate cave. So he's not out in the open. Saul, the king, the deliverer of Israel, is in hiding in a cave. Okay? Not a great place to find the leader of your country. He's supposed to be the defender. But we got to remember where Saul is at this point in his life. As we've already mentioned, he was just told that his dynasty's been rejected. So he's facing an upcoming battle, and the thought's got to be in his mind, is it going to be rejected today? Or is it going to be rejected later on? I mean, is this what God is going to use to remove my kingship from Israel? Is this battle going to be what undoes my dynasty? Am I going to die in this battle? So without those instructions or with that note ringing in his ear, he's holding back quite a bit. But also, he doesn't have any divine guidance saying that God is going to work a deliverance in Israel through him. That puts him in a bad spot. Because normally speaking, what can 600 men do against the tens of thousands camped at Michmash? Normally speaking, if all things were equal, not much. He doesn't stand a chance. And without God's promise of protection and God's promise of intervention, this is a hopeless situation for Saul. So while we see him holding back when he's supposed to be engaging, we can understand a little bit. But also understanding that he's got no weapons. None of his troops have any weapons. And so even if it wasn't hopeless from a numbers standpoint, how do you charge an enemy army when they've got chariots, which were the tanks of the day, and they've got horsemen, and they've got spears, and they've got bows and arrows, and they've got swords and armor, and you're the only guy in your army that's got a weapon in? That makes it a pretty bleak situation. Again, what we looked at last week, though. When the situation gets bleak, what do? You start trusting God more, because you have to. Okay? So, he's got few men to work with. He has no weapons. He's got no divine guidance. So we find Saul hiding in the cave. Second tidbit. Oop, did I skip one? Hold on. Yeah. Second tidbit. With him were about 600 men. We've already talked about how small of a force this is compared to the Philistine force. He started with 3,000 standing men, a standing army, 3,000 people. But as things got worse, while he was staying down at Gilgal waiting for Samuel, everybody fled. He had even called the entire nation of Israel out to fight. So he has seen his army swell from zero to 3,000 to hundreds of thousands and all the way back to 600. So he is riding this emotional roller coaster, poor Saul. But with him is a fellow named Ahijah. Ahijah means friend of God. Ahi is a Hebrew word for friend. Yah is a shortened form of Jehovah or Yahweh. And so Ahijah means friend of God. But look at who this fella is in verse 3. Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother. Anybody remember Ichabod? And it's not Ichabod Crane from the Legend of Sleepy Hollow. Okay? It was always a spooky movie to me. Did anybody else find that movie creepy? I know it's just a cartoon, but it was still spooky. Ichabod is the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the priest of the Lord. Now, we got to go way back in time here for a minute. Take you back to when Samuel was a little boy ministering in the tabernacle. Eli was the high priest, and Eli had two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. They were wicked men. They were desecrating the sacrifices. They were sleeping with the women that served at the tabernacle. They were just generally corrupting the worship of Jehovah throughout Israel, and so God condemned them to death. They died at a battle with the Philistines at Aphek. Remember, they took the ark out because they thought the ark was what was going to save them, and the entire nation of Israel was defeated, and the two sons of Eli were killed. News came back to Eli, and when he heard it, he fell over backwards, broke his neck, and died, because God's judgment was on him as well. But also, when news reached the town, Phinehas' wife was about to give birth. And she gave birth, and just before she died in the process, she named her baby Ichabod. Yeah, Ichabod. Great name. Anybody know what Ichabod means? It's made up of, you know what, Eldon? Yes, the glory has departed. It's made up of two Hebrew words, I and Chabed. Okay, Chabed means glorious or weighty, something momentous, something heavy. It's often used of God's glory. He is Chabed. And I means without. It's sort of like our prefix, ah. Atheist means someone who no God, doesn't believe in God. Ichabod means no glory, or the glory has departed. So she sees the death of her husband, the death of Eli the high priest, the defeat of Israel, the capture of the ark, and she names her son Ichabod. No glory. How'd you like to go through life bearing that testimony to everybody? What's your name? My name's Inglorious. My name's No Glory. Anyway, coming down here, it has been about 20-some years since the ark was captured. And remember, it went through the Philistine territories, and the Philistines finally sent it back, and it was housed at Kiriath Jearim. So it's back in Israelite hands, but that was about 20 years ago. So 20 years later, it's actually, I think, 26 years later, Ahijah, who is related to Ichabod, okay? Ahijah's dad is Ichabod's older brother. Obviously, Ichabod didn't have any younger brothers because his dad was killed in the battle and his mom died giving birth to him. But he's got an older brother named Achitub. And so Ahijah is a nephew to Ichabod. They're the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the priest of the Lord in Shiloh. But there's something important about Ahijah. What's he wearing? The ephod. The ephod was worn by the high priest. So Saul has with him now, the current ruling high priest of Israel, is with him in his cave, and he's got the ephod. On the ephod were, number one, all sorts of ornate jewelry, 12 stones representing the 12 tribes of Israel. It was a very beautiful garment to represent bearing the names of, or bearing the 12 tribes before the presence of God. But on the shoulders, on each shoulder, were two gemstones set into this thing. One was called the Urim, and the other was called the Thummim. It means lights and glories. We're not entirely sure how these were used, but we know what they were used for. They were used to discern the will of God. So they would take this Urim and this Thummim, and somehow they would inquire of God what His will is for the people of Israel, and He would answer through the Urim and the Thummim. And they were authoritative answers. If you got an answer through the Urim and Thummim, you could rest upon the fact that that is what God wanted you to do. Now, why is that significant here? Because Paul's sitting in his cave, not Paul, Saul is sitting in this cave, the entire Philistine army is across the way, and he's got the ephod with the high priest with him. But he hasn't done anything with them. He hasn't sought the Lord. He hasn't sought the Lord's favor. He hasn't sought to restore himself to the Lord through sacrifice, through inquiring of the Lord. He hasn't asked what to do, but he's got the ephod there. But we find Saul once again sort of wrapped up in himself in indecision, so that he's sitting in his cave. The very fact that the verse 1 says one day tells us that some amount of time has passed. Probably hasn't been a long time. I wouldn't say on the order of months, but maybe on the order of a week or 2 weeks. Saul's been hiding in his cave while the Philistine army has been garrisoned at Michmash and sending out raiding parties all through Israel. And what is the king of Israel doing? He's doing nothing. He's terrified. He's got himself tied up in knots, and he's not doing anything to deliver his people, even though he has the resources to do it, because he's got God's direction right there. Another little tidbit. Oh, I already told you that. Saul's got the means for God's guidance, but he's sitting still. Now, it's going to describe for us a little bit of the landscape. So I'm going to read this verse, and we're going to take a look at the map up here. Within the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a rocky crag on the one side and a rocky crag on the other side. The name of the one was Bozez, the name of the other, Senna. The one crag rose on the north in front of Michmash, and the other on the south in front of Geba. These sort of descriptions are hard for us to get, not seeing the landscape. I don't know if you guys are visual learners like I am. If somebody sits down and tries to describe to you in words where things are, it sort of gets jumbled up in my brain, and I just can't get it out. So I like to be able to see things. So here is a map of the area we're looking at. Right down, let me turn on my laser pointer here. Can you see that? Okay. Right here is Gibeah. This is Saul's hometown. And the passage tells us that he is encamped on the outskirts, up here somewhere, okay, in a cave. You can see, this is a topographical map, so you can see that it's sort of hilly in this area. It'd be a great place for a cave to be. Okay? 2.5 miles from Gibeah is another little town called Geba, not to be confused. They are different towns, very close together. What's 2.5 miles from here? There's not a town 2.5 miles from Mendota, is there? Troy Grove is what, about 7? Okay, so it'd be like going from here out to Gary's place over by the interstate. And it's about 2.5 miles, okay? So it's not all that far. You could, if you were really in a hurry, you could march across it in about an hour. Okay? So this is Geba. This is Geba. Just a little bit north and to the east of Geba is Michmash. This is where the Philistines are camped, all in this area. Now, there are 30,000 chariots, 4,000 horsemen, and numerous soldiers. So we can imagine that their camp is spread out all over these hills. This is exactly where you don't want to be, because this is full of the bad guy. This is full of the enemy. And Jonathan's brave plan, as he says to his armor bearer, "Hey, let's go over to the Philistine garrison and see what we can do about this." Talk about a faithful plan. Talk about a man full of faith who understands what he's going to tell us here in just a minute. We'll come back to the map here. But Jonathan says this to his armor bearer, and this is what is really amazing about this passage. "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. For nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few." Here's what Jonathan understands about God. God doesn't need us. God could squash this whole Philistine army right now, and he doesn't need a single sword to be drawn against them. He doesn't need a single Israelite soldier to go over there. It wouldn't matter if we had 400,000 troops and take them over there, or if we had 4 troops. It doesn't matter to God. A lot of times in the church today, we act like God just, oh wow, we really need to get enough money to accomplish God's plan, don't we? Got to have that $65 million jet. We were talking about that in Sunday school. Okay. Got to have that $65. How else are we going to witness to people if we don't have all these things? Do you know what? God does not need your money. And the deacons are saying, "Pastor, Does he want you to give it? Absolutely, but he doesn't need the money. I remember one time in one of my more cheeky episodes, we were sitting in seminary class, and the professor was talking about these new technologies they were going to get in. They were going to get a projector like we've got in every classroom, and a computer, and electronic whiteboards. And it's just like a big computer screen, and you write on them, and you can, I mean, not with a pen, it's all digital, but pretty nifty things. He says, this is going to be amazing what we're going to do, and I shouldn't have said this because it was snarky, okay? But I said, isn't it going to be amazing what God can do when we finally give him the resources to do it? And he looked at me and said, well, yeah, I guess so. But sometimes we get that mentality and we think God's got to have all these things. God's got to have a building here to have a church, right? Does there need to be a building here? No, because what's the church? You are. We could all gather out there in the field and worship the Lord. Oh, we're glad to have the church building. Gives us a great, it is a great tool for us. It's a great resource, but we don't need it, do we? God doesn't need us. But here's something else Jonathan recognizes. God is going to work through us. We are not indispensable. None of us is. None of us has some gift or some ability that God can't do without. Because all of our gifts and all of our strengths mean absolutely nothing in His plan. It's Him that is working through us. We just sang the song. Every promise we can make, every prayer, step of faith, it's only by His grace. He gives that to us anyway. So Jonathan recognizes, well, if it's by God's grace and it's by God's power, then it doesn't matter that we're only two people. God can save by 100,000, God can save by two. So let's go over and see what God will do. Now, he's not saying that he is guaranteeing that God is going to give him the victory. And here's where we run into a little difference between our understanding and the prosperity gospel. See? Did God ever promise to make me rich? No. If he does, is that a blessing? Sure. Use it for him. But he never promised to make me rich. You know what he did promise to do? Provide my need. Now, what I need or what I want are two different things. But he did promise to provide my need. And Jonathan is not saying, Lord, we're going to go over there and we're going to stomp all over these enemies and I just claim it because I know you're going to do it. He said, the Lord might because he can. And so let's go see what he's going to do. So Jonathan displays an amazing faith here. But I don't want to pass over the faith of this next guy. Look at the armor-bearer's response. Verse 7, and his armor-bearer said to him, do all that is in your heart. Do as you wish. Behold, I am with you, heart and soul. Jonathan, I am with you. I'm on board with this plan. Now, you notice that one little word there in the second sentence that this guy says. Do as you wish. And what's the next word? Behold. Now, we've mentioned behold several times in our morning service talking about the Gospel of Matthew. It means, here's something out of the ordinary, now pay attention. So, the armor bearer is saying to Jonathan, I know it's crazy, but you know what? I'm on board with this plan. I know this sounds absolutely ridiculous, but you know what? Let's go do it. You and me against 40,000. Minimum number. Okay? Behold, I'm with you. Now, very rarely has God ever worked a work that has changed the world with just one guy. There's almost always people standing behind him. The Lord Jesus, probably the only exception because everybody fled. But even Paul had Silas and Timothy. And isn't it great to know that in the moment when you're going to have to stand up and do something faithful that looks crazy to everybody else, God's probably going to provide somebody with you that's going to stand up and say, you know what? Yeah, let's do it. Because how many of us can stand without anybody supporting us? There's a statement that I've found absolutely true, and that is a man can stand against the whole world as long as his wife's behind him. But we got to have support. And God provides that support for Jonathan. He says, look, all right, I'm with you. What's your plan? So here's Jonathan's bold venture. Okay, this is a lesson for all military tacticians. Okay, this is great. Look at what he says here. Jonathan said, behold, we will cross over to the men, and we will show ourselves to them. Right off the bat, this is not going to be a surprise attack. We're not going to try and sneak in at night. We're not going to try and kill them while they're all sleeping, and hopefully we can get as many as we can. We're going to walk right over to that Philistine camp, and we're going to say, here we are. We're going to show ourselves to them. And this is where all the military generals are saying, that sounds crazy. That sounds nuts. That's not how you fight battles. That's not how you win wars. You remember back in the Revolutionary War when George Washington was was leading our armies and training them? He trained them to actually do the smart thing and hide behind the rocks, because the British armies were marching all in formation, lined up right next to each other like good little ducks at a shooting range. And George Washington trained our men to say, get behind that rock and hide yourself. You don't march up like that. That's crazy warfare. That's warfare from back in the times when we were using swords and spears. We got bullets and guns now. You don't fight like that anymore. And so they don't train our soldiers to line up like that anymore. Now you spread out. But Jonathan says, okay, we're going to march right up there, and we are going to show ourselves to the enemy. This is going to be great. We're going to show ourselves. It's not going to be a surprise attack. Look what else he says. If they say to us, wait until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place, and we will not go up to them. So we're going to march over there, and we're going to say, hey guys, here we are, and here's a little test that Jonathan's going to throw out to determine what God's will is. Now understand, there's a difference between determining what God's will is and testing God. If God has clearly said to you, do this, and you say, Lord, I'm not really sure I should do this. Give me some sign that I should do this. You are testing God. So do you ever need to throw the fleece out there? We look at Gideon and we say, oh yeah, just throw a fleece out there. God had already told Gideon what to do. God's gracious. He gave Gideon those answers to reaffirm him. But Gideon's not a great example for us to follow. God had already told him what to do. So if God says, Matt, don't steal, and you're walking around over there at Stonecroft one day and you see someone left their watch sitting on the table. Woohoo! I wonder if I should take that. Lord, did you provide this for me to provide for my need? No. That's a test. You're testing God. You're not trying to determine His will. He's already told you what it is. So Jonathan's not testing God. He is trying to determine, God, what should I do? Because he hasn't had any clear revelation on what to do next. So he's going to use the circumstances as a clue here. And he says, if they say, wait until we come to you, then we don't go up. Because here's what it shows. If they say, stay there, wait till we come to you, it means the Philistine camp is on their guard. They're not letting an enemy come into the camp. And probably, if they come down to fetch Jonathan, they're going to disarm him before they take him back bound to the camp. So that's going to be a bad sign for Jonathan. He's not pulling these things arbitrarily out of the air and just saying, well, you know what? If A happens, then bing, we'll flip the coin. That means it's good. The same thing happened when Abraham sent his servant back to Haran to find a wife for his son Isaac. Remember when the servant got there and he prayed and said, Lord, let the first girl that comes out and says, I'll give you water to drink and I'll give water to your camels also. That's the one that you want to marry my master's son. Did he pull that out of the air? No. Because those actions described a character trait of servanthood that he wanted to see in his master's wife. He wasn't just flipping a coin. He wanted to see specific character traits in this gal, and so he said, Lord, send me the right gal. Send me the gal that's got the character that you want for my master. And God did. So that's what Jonathan's doing here. If they say, wait until we come to you, that shows they're on their guard, and it would mean Jonathan and his armor bearer would probably be disarmed and detained before they could get up there. So he says, if they say that, we're staying here and we're not going up. That means the Lord's not going to deliver the Philistines into our hands. But If they say to us, come up to us, then we will go up. For the Lord has given them into our hand, and this shall be the sign to them, to us. So the answer is, if they say, come on up here, it means the Philistines are not on their guard. They're inviting us to come up armed. So they're not watching the camp. They're awfully arrogant. They're awfully assured of their own defenses. And that's going to mean they're not looking for us to attack. So it will be somewhat of a surprise, won't it? So if they say, come on up, Jonathan's got the answer that he's looking for. Now what's God going to do? Verse 11, both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves. Remember, the Hebrews had fled and hid in cisterns and in caves and in holes in the ground. So when they see Jonathan coming up, they think he's just appeared out of one of these holes in the ground. So they say, hey, look, the Hebrews are finally coming up. And the man of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor-bearer and said, come up to us and we'll show you something. Yeah, right. What are you going to show me? Yeah, the tip of your spear? Okay. But Jonathan knows he's hearing the answer from God. Come on up. And Jonathan said to his armor-bearer, come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hand of Israel. Here's where his faith really turns into something courageous, because now it's time to go to work. Now he has divine guidance. Now he's got God's answer. This is what I want you to do. So how many of us would have the courage to actually climb that hill? Because you know at the top of that hill, there's at least 50,000 angry, mean-looking Philistines waiting for you, and they've all got sharp, pointy weapons. And you've got a weapon, and your armor-bearer's got a weapon, and you look behind you, and whose else is coming? Nobody. So this is where Jonathan really displays this great faith, because he says, let's go up there. I don't care how many of them there are. God's going to deliver them into our hand. You see why this really starts to mirror David's encounter with Goliath? So we can see why Jonathan and David are souls knit together, because they both believe in the same God, a God that can do anything he wants to do, a God that will intervene in miraculous ways on behalf of his people. And so he says, let's go. Come up after me. The Lord has given them into the hand of Israel. Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet, and his armor-bearer after him. Now, remember the description that was given to us of the landscape. It says there was a rocky crag on the north and a rocky crag on the south. Jonathan's down in this valley. And over there in Israel, the land is very sharp. The hills are not gently rolling hills down in the southern portion of Israel. They're very steep, they're rocky, they're hard to climb, and there's a lot of what are called wadis, which are basically the little canyons that the streams have carved into the earth. And the sides of them are very steep, and they can go up 100 feet or more. So Jonathan's down inside one of those, and he sees the Philistines. Hey guys, we're down here! Hey, I'm just inviting you to throw rocks on us or shoot us with arrows or something. And the Philistine says, come on up here. So he says, let's go get him. So he climbs up on his hands and knees. And again, this is not the way to initiate a battle. You do not want to arrive at the battle exhausted. But he climbs up on his hands and knees because he knows it doesn't matter about his own strength, because who's fighting this battle? God is. Who's going to give the victory? God is. He doesn't have to arrive there fresh, refreshed and rested and ready to go. Roaring to go, right? But not only is it exhausting, it's indefensible. Now, how are you going to be able to defend yourself when you're climbing up this hill? Because all they have to do is push a big rock down, and you're done. They can stand up there and shoot arrows at you, throw spears, and you're not going to be able to defend yourself. But Jonathan knows it's not him that's fighting the battle, it's God. So it doesn't matter. I can expose myself to all sorts of dangers because God's the one that's going to fight for me, if I'm doing what he tells me to do. There's a big difference, isn't there? So, the unbelievable victory continues on. Look what happens. He gets to the top. Jonathan climbed up on his hands and his feet and his armor-bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan, and his armor-bearer killed them after him. So Jonathan gets to the top of this hill. He starts running forward, and he's wounding the men and knocking them down, and his armor-bearer is coming behind him and finishing them off. and this explosion happens in the camp of the Philistines. Now, we don't know exactly what's going on here. Why? How is it that two men could cause this great of a panic in the camp of tens of thousands, except that God did it? Because Jonathan explodes over that hillside. He's not exhausted. He's full of energy. Reminds us of what Isaiah said, that even the youths will faint and grow weary, but they that wait upon the Lord will renew their strength. They will mount up with wings as eagles. Jonathan certainly experienced this in this battle because he gets to the top of the hill, runs forward, and he's able to knock the people down and wound them, and then his armor-bearer comes after and finishes them off. They fell before Jonathan, and his armor-bearer killed them after him. And that first strike, verse 14, which Jonathan and his armor-bearer made, killed about 20 men within, as it were, half a furrow's length of an acre of land. I forgot to check I was going to how long an acre of land is. Jerry, do you know? From your farming days? No. Anybody know how long is an acre? Eldon? Okay. About 4.5. Square root of that is. Okay. Be somewhere around 200, wouldn't it? A little over 200 feet. So let's just go with that. If an acre is 200 feet and he's about half of that, in 100 feet, Jonathan runs 100 feet and he's able to kill 20 guys. 20 guys out of tens of thousands of them. That's not a huge impact, is it? And yet it is a huge impact because, again, it doesn't matter what you can do. It matters what God can do. And so Jonathan kills these 20 people, and look at what happens in the camp of the Philistines. He kills 20 people in about 100 feet, and there was a panic in the camp and in the field and among all the people. The garrison and even the raiders trembled. Now, where are the raiders? They've been going throughout the land of Israel. We don't know how far away they are at this point. But Jonathan storms that first 100 feet. He kills 20 people, an insignificant number almost, and God spreads this panic throughout the camp of the Philistines so that not only is the camp feeling the weight of Jonathan's onslaught, but all the people in the field around the camp and among all the rest of the people outside of that and even the raiders that are scattered throughout the nation of Israel, they hear about this and they're terrified. Now, probably what they're thinking is that all the Hebrews have risen up out of the holes in the ground and are coming to attack from all directions, which is actually what is going to happen. But this unbelievable victory is that this two guys, and they accomplish something that's almost insignificant. They only killed 20 Philistines out of tens of thousands. Now, I know that's a big deal. I couldn't kill 20 guys in 100 feet. I could kill myself climbing up that rocky crag that he climbed up, okay? And I would probably just put my hands on the top and roll over and say, just go ahead. Finish me off, please. Okay? But compared to the problem, it's almost insignificant. But God works in a miraculous way here. Look at what it also says. Not only are the people terrified, all the Philistines are panicked, but the earth quaked, and it became a very great panic. Look at God intervening on the behalf of His people. He sends an earthquake in just to solidify the impact of what Jonathan's done. It's an unbelievable victory. God Himself steps into this battle because Jonathan has got the faith to say, it doesn't matter what I've got. What matters is what God wants to accomplish. What's God want to accomplish in your life? What's God want to accomplish through you? We're not a huge church. We might never be. Does that mean God's not going to accomplish big things through His people? We don't have to have all the resources in the world. We don't have to have tons of resources, huge building. What we've got to have is a faith in a God that can accomplish big things through little people. Jonathan displays that for us. So the kingly lesson, I was going to cover a little bit more, but we'll pause there. The kingly lesson is exactly what Jonathan already told us. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few. So what problem is it you're facing in your life right now that you need to remember? And God doesn't need big things, because God is big all by Himself. Let's pray.